I think with Al-Qaeda, it is their strength really is in their resilience and in their longevity. So they showed strategic patience at a time when ISIL was the big news. And Al-Qaeda said at the time that they thought ISIL were premature and reckless. And I think they feel that that's been vindicated, that ISIL has, you know, suffered the predictable defeats because of its recklessness. And so that has given Ayman al-Zawahiri and Al-Qaeda the sense that they were probably right to play the long game.
So where should we be looking out for the next attack to come from?
If we're looking for the immediate threat, where is the next attack most likely to come from? Particularly attacks, international attacks or attacks outside conflict zones, outside insurgency operations, it's still ISIL. ISIL is the more likely. And this is a problem for Al-Qaeda because Al-Qaeda eventually is going to have, it runs the risk again of people saying, well, what does it really do? Because its biggest operational successes are now a long way behind.
So if we're looking at that scenario, then should we even really pay any attention to Al-Qaeda anymore?
Still has a lot of iconic brand recognition because of its previous operational activities. And what Al-Qaeda has done is it has embedded itself much more than ISIL in local conflicts. And it has got involved in the politics of various regions.
So has this development led to anything that we should be focused on or make us remember why they are so dangerous?
The destabilization of parts of West Africa, and particularly the Sahel area. You have an Al-Qaeda-affiliated coalition called Jamaat Nusrat al-Islam wal-Muslimin, which is having a lot of success in destabilizing Mali and Burkina Faso and starting to threaten and unsettle other regional states. So that's interesting. Another Al-Qaeda affiliate, of course, Al-Shabaab in Somalia, remains very resilient and effective in its area of operations. The third I should mention, of course, is northwestern Syria. It's a complex picture in northwestern Syria, but the strongest groups there around Idlib are Al-Qaeda affiliated. You have the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, which is not on good terms with Al-Qaeda, but is still loosely affiliated with Al-Qaeda. And then you have Haras ad-Din, which is sometimes referred to by people as Al-Qaeda Syria, and which is a much purer manifestation of Al-Qaeda's global agenda in Syria. And these groups are strong. They have a lot of fighters, and they have quite a lot of foreign terrorist fighters amongst them as well. So there is a threat from Al-Qaeda. It's mainly projected in these conflict zones, but we can't relax on this. It's entirely possible that Al-Qaeda will resume international attacks at some point.
We've heard that Russia had been paying bounties to the Taliban to kill American troops in Afghanistan, and we've heard the same thing about Iran. What have you heard about this?
I mean, I have no information about that at all. What I will say is that the Taliban is engaged in a peace process with the United States, and we are very much hoping that that peace process will start to get a meaningful traction inside Afghanistan in intra-Afghan talks between the Taliban and the government of Afghanistan and other constituencies in Afghanistan. So that's very much the news that we've focused on in the reports that we have covered. Some of the international dimensions of Afghanistan are controversial. There's a lot of reporting, but we are very much focused on the peace process.
Does Russia, to your knowledge, have a relationship with the Taliban?
I'm not aware that Russia has any more of a relationship with the Taliban than other international players who are seeking to support the peace process in Afghanistan. One of the things that we do, because as you know, we work with the 1267 and 1988 committees, it's the 1988 committee that is concerned with the Taliban and with peace and security in Afghanistan. And of course, there is a travel ban, an arms embargo, an asset freeze in force on the Taliban. And we are very much concerned with making sure that the necessary exemptions are agreed by the committee so that member states can legitimately engage with the Taliban in support of the peace process.
What's the leadership like in the Taliban? Who leads that organization now?
Well, that's a very good question. And as you know, this has always been a point of obscurity here in Afghanistan when Mullah Omar died, and then there was a prolonged period while that was not acknowledged. And so one of the interesting questions, which we cover in detail in our most recent report on Afghanistan, is what is the state of the leadership of the Taliban? How cohesive is it? You've got various constituencies within the Taliban. You've got tribal groupings. You've got people based in different locations. And whilst it is true that the organization has managed to maintain a sort of strategic discipline and a very strong commitment to the success of the overall organization, there's a lot of disagreement over tactics and certain amount of disagreement over politics. And this is where the peace process is interesting because, of course, the point at which the Taliban comes into direct negotiation with its Afghan partners is the point at which it may have to make meaningful compromises. There are constituencies within the Taliban who are against compromise and think that the Taliban can win by force. And the interesting key point here is when compromises are necessary, does the leadership have the authority to drive that through? The son of Mullah Omar is important in this. Siraj Haqqani, the head of the Haqqani network, is important in this. But it is not entirely clear how the Taliban will be able to maintain discipline once it has to take hard decisions.
Edmund Fitton Brown is the coordinator of the UN's Al-Qaeda Taliban ISIS monitoring team. JJ Green, WTOP News.